Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world accessing the show on the internet. We have four studio guests this week, no more nor less. Chris Lees from the UKIP Party, Nicky Jones is here to talk about Britain's arms trade, Dan Isles from the Convention of the Left group in Easton, and Paul Hazelden from the Homeless Project in St Paul's. Our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Greaves as ever reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Carter is here once again, the Bard of Windmill Hill and the Bard of Dalek Radio, to read his latest poem. And Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman, and first I'd like to welcome to the studio Mr. Paul Hazelden. Hello.
Hello there.
You are a member or a contributor to the Crisis Centre Ministries. So tell me a little bit about who they are and how long this affair has been going.
Okay, well, Crisis Centre was set up about 25 years ago by a chap called Derek Groves, who wanted to do something about the problem of drugs and alcohol and, you know, people getting into those sort of problems and getting arrested and locked away and causing all sorts of social problems. Wanted to try and do something to stop those problems.
Right, okay. I suppose the first thing that leaps to mind, I guess, would be obviously the recession. Most people probably assume your workload probably goes up. Is this probably a correct assumption?
Our workload gets more difficult, but it's the number of homeless people doesn't increase overnight because of a recession. Mm-hmm. You don't end up on the streets just because you get into financial difficulties.
Right.
Most people end up on the streets because of financial difficulties and family breakdown and sort of problems with work and.
Right.
So it takes a while.
I
so guess. We're expecting the homeless population to increase long term as a result of the recession. But
okay,
the short term effect is that much less money is available, not just to us, but to charities across the country.
So just when it gets most difficult is the time
the money gets cut.
Okay. So how many of you are there working for the Crisis Centre Ministries?
We've got a staff of six people and we've got about 125 volunteers who come in on a regular basis.
Right, okay. Tell me a little bit about homelessness, because people assume, I have sort of assumed in the past, it's fairly sort of black and white. Do you get sort of different kinds of homeless people?
There are many, many different sorts of homelessness. I mean, the obvious sorts that people think of is the street homeless, you know, people sleeping rough, and those are the ones that are counted on a regular basis. Because the council are obliged to do that.
Right.
But there are many other sorts of homelessness. I mean, everybody sleeping in the hostel is homeless. People sleeping on friends' floors, on settees, people sleeping in caravans and in tents in the woods, people sleeping in squats. So there's many, many different situations, and they're all homeless.
How many of those do you think are vulnerable with drug addiction problems, do you think?
Almost everybody you see on the streets has some sort of problem with addiction,
okay.
Whether they started off that way or whether they got into it as a result of the difficulty of the lifestyle.
Okay, so what do you do? Like, if a vulnerable person or damaged person like sort of kicks off, I mean, does that happen often?
It doesn't happen as often as you'd expect. We are a voluntary group, you know, so most of the people who work with us are, you know, volunteers. They're giving their time for free. And so that makes a completely different relationship to the folk who work in the statutory services.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're there in order to provide a service, then people expect that service of you. And if you don't deliver it and deliver it now, then they get upset and, you know, things get difficult. But if they know you're there because you've got no reason to be there, but simply because you care about people, then they appreciate what you do. And they're far less likely to kick off and create difficulty.
Right. I understand you were possibly involved in last week's Secret Millionaire film. Is this correct?
Well, we did feature as an organisation there. It's the Wild Goose Coffee Shop was sort of one of the three charities that were featured in the programme last night.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I was involved behind the scenes.
Okay.
Negotiating with the production company and so on.
I guess any publicity is good publicity, I suppose.
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful publicity.
Okay. So what sort of projects and stuff have you been doing lately to sort of try and, as a sort of schemes to try and help the homeless?
Well, we provide a coffee shop and drop-in centre for people to come in where they're just welcomed and given food and something to drink and something warm.
And where is that?
And that's in City Road in St Paul's. That's the Wild Goose.
Okay.
And by doing that, we build relationships with people and we get to know them. We get to find out what's holding them back, what's causing the problems, and what they would like to do about it.
Yeah.
So we don't impose anything, but we just find out where people are and build a relationship of trust. And from there, we find very often that something can be done to help a person move forward. One of the things that we provide for folk who are moving forward is a life skills training course. So help people to get the skills that they didn't gain very often as children.
Okay.
And
what sort of networks do you build? Is there a lot of other support for homeless people in Bristol? I mean, what sort of networks do you have with other organisations?
There's around 30 different voluntary sector groups working with homeless people on a daily or weekly basis in Bristol, alongside all the statutory activities. Right. So there is a massive amount of work going on.
So sort of to try and finish the interview, I mean, what sort of things could people do if they think, well, I want to get involved, what can they do to help, or how can they get involved?
Well, obviously, all these charities need money to survive, so yeah, donations are always welcome.
Okay, how can people donate?
Through our website, which is www.crisis-centre.org.uk.
Okay.
And many of these have lots of opportunities for volunteers, there are always opportunities for people to get involved one way or another.
Okay, so that's crisis-centre.org.uk.
That's it, yes.
Brilliant. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you short there, I'm afraid, because we've talked about that for a lot longer. But Paul Hazelden, thank you very much for coming in.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. My next guest I'd like to introduce is Chris Lees of the United Kingdom Independence Party. Hello.
Hi, good evening, John.
And I understand you used to be a member of the Liberal Democrat Party before you joined UKIP, is that right?
I did indeed, yeah. From, I think it was 2002, I joined the Liberal Democrat Party. And I think I lasted about 18 months there. I was elected as a councillor in South Gloucestershire. Mm-hmm. So I became a South Gloucestershire councillor there. I stood from 2003 through to 2007. But in 2004, I decided that I'd had enough of the Liberal Democrats, because I didn't find them very liberal, and I certainly didn't find them democratic.
Right, okay.
So I decided to jump ship, and I joined the UK Independence Party for reasons which...
I mean, a lot of people are not necessarily clear what the Liberal Democrats particularly stand for. So what was it that attracted you to them? What was it they stood for?
Do you know what? I don't think that they really know what the Liberal Democrats actually stand for, I have to say. You know what? I'd come back from Spain in 2002, and I guess I'd always been a kind of an old Tory voter, really.
Okay. Have you been involved in politics?
I'd never been involved in politics, but I can always remember voting for Mrs. Thatcher and, of course, running my own business, etc. I always thought that, you know, that was the way, and on reflection, maybe not. But I did join the Liberal Democrats because I honestly believed that they were trying to pursue policies that were democratic and did liberate people, in other words, to try and get a smaller government.
Yeah.
And I soon found, being involved with them for a while, that that wasn't the case. I mean, they're very, very wedded, for example, to the concepts of the European Union, which personally I'm not, for a lot of reasons. And I also believe that the European Union, by its very nature, it promotes and it involves big government.
Yep.
So again, that kind of went against what I was about. And I used to bring these issues up with the Liberal Democrats, and I used to try and put an alternative view.
Yeah,
it wasn't very welcome. So okay. I thought, well, hey, you know.
In your role as a businessman, what was it about that put you off big government? What puts you off the idea?
Well, I think as a businessman, and it's the ability to do something, the ability to make something happen, the ability to create some wealth. I remember I first moved to Spain in 1983, and I wanted to set up a company there, but I had great difficulty doing it because you had to have a license for this, a license for that, a piece of paper from the police, another license, and you could never have enough licenses. You know, I mean, literally was like that to open a hot dog stall in those days. You know, and I thought, this is absolutely absurd. You know, why is it like this? And over here in the United Kingdom, if I wanted to set up a business and do something, I could just say, right, I'm going to be a sole trader, or you know what, I'm going to set up a limited company, and I could do that for £50. I don't need lawyers involved or anything. And I can go out there, open a bank, and I can trade, literally, the same day. So you couldn't do that in Spain. You can't do that now in Spain. You certainly can't do that in most companies, countries of Europe, I have to say.
When you joined UKIP, I mean, a lot of people think it's sort of just another branch of the Conservative Party, so to speak. How did you find, you know, the Bristol branch of UKIP? What sort of people did you find there?
Well, absolutely great. What I found with these people were that they were the libertarian people. I think there's a lot of bad press, or there has been a lot of bad press about UKIP over the past. You know, we're not, and they are certainly not, right-wing nutters.
Yeah, well, Kilroy Sigg probably hasn't really helped you.
Well, he was a left-wing nutter, wasn't he, to start off with? He was a Labour MP, and he was a Marxist at university, so it was Mr. Kilroy Sigg. So, yeah, he was a left-wing nutter.
Okay.
And he's no longer on the scene. He's kind of retired and lives in his villa up in the hills in Marbella. Lucky him, topping up his tam. But no, you know, we are all from the thought process of being a lot free, libertarianism, to be allowed to do things, to be allowed to speak our mind, to be allowed to go about our business. With
doesn't it also mean a lot of people are free to do an awful lot of bad things? I mean, isn't that why we introduced regulation in the first place?
I mean, people do bad things, don't they? And I certainly don't condone people doing bad things. But what we have to understand, we have to decide what are bad things. And as a society, we have to decide what are bad things, and then we have to decide as a society how to legislate against those bad things. What we have now, certainly with the European Union, is kind of the other way around, where everything is a bad thing, and they will legislate to allow us to do things.
Okay.
Where we've always traditionally had this Anglo-Saxon way of saying, well, we're all born free people, we can all do what we like, and we will decide as a society that, you know, we don't murder people and we don't do this, that and the other.
Yeah, okay.
So that's where we're coming from.
I mean, I understand when you went to Spain, you went to Spain, you had a bad experience there. What happened? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I did. It was very bad. It was I was arrested.
What for?
I was accused of being an international drugs trafficker.
Right.
Which, you know, wasn't funny at the time, but I do kind of look back and laugh. And anybody that would have known me would have known that I'd be the last person to think of that you'd accuse of being that.
Okay.
Been a non-smoker, never done drugs in my life.
Mistaken identity?
No, it wasn't. In fact, I run a real estate business, and we rented out a house, a villa, down near the coast in Marbella, something that was on our books. A member of my staff had rented it out to somebody who came in.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of months into this rental, I got a phone call at home from the police in the evening, and they asked me a couple of questions. They said, look, did you rent this villa? Because we found your pack, you know, your property company's details in the kitchen. I said, well, I guess if you found out there, we probably did. I said, I don't know. I need to get up to the office and find out. So very civilly, kind of made an appointment to go and see them the following day. But they did tell me on the phone that they'd had it under surveillance, this property. And they'd arrested a couple of North African men, and they'd found 3.5 tonne of cannabis resin.
Right.
So they told me this on the telephone, so it was a very serious matter. And I just wanted to help them out as much as I could. So I remember going up to the office and getting the file and getting the people in and saying, hey, you know, what's going on? Let us find out. So I got the file up together with a copy of the guy's passport that rented it, and a receipt for the monies and the contracts mm-hmm. that had been signed, all the things you needed to do. And I went down to the police station, was called into a back room, I was assaulted by the police. They broke my nose and beat me up, and I ended up on the floor, and they threw some photographs at me and said, we've got something of yours. You're an international drugs trafficker, you're an English this, that and the other, and you're going to prison for a long time. And I half expected Jeremy Beadle to jump out of a cupboard at this moment in time, but
okay.
I think I was somewhere else. And that's what they said. So they accused me of actually
and what happened as
doing
a,
this.
As a result of that?
So, well, I mean, I kind of managed to compose myself, and I was able to phone a friend of mine who's a lawyer, who was the company lawyer, Antonio, and he came down and he was shocked by what had gone on. They kept me in the police station in Marbella overnight, downstairs in this horrible cell. And they threw me a blanket. I mean, it must have been 100 degrees down there. It was awful. I remember they threw me this blanket if I got cold. There was no chance of that. I mean, and the blanket sort of stood up on its own, you know, and it walked on its own as well. And there were fleas jumping off it. And it wasn't good, you know.
Yeah.
And it smelt a bit. Anyway, so the following day, they dragged me up to the courthouse. made me way out there handcuffed, and they took me into this little office, and we made a statement to the court, basically saying this is absurd. And the prosecutor came in and said, we want to investigate this further. We think that there might be some cause for concern here. So with that, they said, right, off you go. And I was put in prison, ended up going into the van with four other people, up to Malaga jail, and it took me a year to get out.
A whole year?
A whole year. I languished in there. I was on hunger strike for a while.
Did you feel that that was indicative of the way that Spain runs, or that the EU runs, or did it?
That is a fault of the Spanish justice system, mm-hmm. which is still as it is today, as it was then, as it was under Franco. I've since found out, of course, that it's indicative of most of the European justice systems, France, Italy, Greece, Portugal.
Is that purely on the neglect on an individual basis, or do you?
It's a completely different system. We have this wonderful term here, habeas corpus, mm-hmm. literally, which means you have to bring the body and you have to show this body in front of his peers, yeah. and there has to be due cause for this body to be held and incarcerated. It doesn't happen like
Surely
that.
Surely the EU is an example, an opportunity for you to get involved and to kind of spread good laws across a land where many disparate laws
Absolutely.
Are proven to be inefficient.
Yeah, I mean, things are moving at such a pace now, and they have done over the years since this happened to me in Spain, where we see more and more repressive law mm-hmm. being brought in, and I think we all can see what's happening here in the United Kingdom. But we have to understand that where it's actually coming from and where it's being driven from, it is being driven from the European Union, because they wish to bring this law of corpus juris here into the United Kingdom. So bit by bit, we're slowly cutting our old ways of doing away yeah. and bringing this system in. And that is why we're all worried about this, okay. I think, you know.
Okay, so you're standing in the Bristol West against the Liberal Democrat candidate Stephen Williams.
Yes, I am indeed.
Is that going down well with him?
I remember at the 2005 general election, I stood in Bristol North West, and I was on a debate with Stephen Williams, and he called me a xenophobe, which I didn't like too much.
Okay, so I'm
looking forward to getting the gloves off again with Stephen.
Okay, so do you think you're going to lose your deposit possibly?
Absolutely not.
No? Absolutely not. Yeah. Vicious
very,
fighting
very
words.
Very confident. There,
okay, yeah. So in one very brief sentence, why should people vote for you? What's so great about you that Stephen Williams
well,
hasn't got?
Certainly people should vote for me because what we're looking to do is we're looking to get rid of all these oppressive, ridiculous, stupid systems that have been brought in over the years. And let's just get back to plain old common sense, really.
Okay,
the simple things in life. That's what we need to be doing.
Chris Lees of the United Kingdom Independence Party, candidate for Bristol West in the coming election. Thank you very much for coming
John,
in.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My son John was tall and slim, he had a leg for every limb. Now he's got no legs at all, 'cause he run a race with a cannonball, with a cannonball. He run a race with a cannonball. Jack the lad, he went off to war, away bye-bye as he ran out the door. Says bye bye John, when I see you again, you'll be back from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from the Taliban. You'll be back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I sat down each day on the shore for the space of 7 long years or more, till a big transport come across the sky and I shouted aloud, really, clear the way, clear the way. I shouted aloud, will you clear the way? I shouted aloud till the captain said, are you here with the living, are you back with the dead? Did you see anything of my son John? Is the boy living or is he gone? Is he gone? Is the poor boy living or is he gone? Up come John and he's got no legs, got carbon fiber blades instead. She smiled and she kissed him over and over, but you're uncrippled and you'd deaf? Were you blind when you left your own two legs behind? Or did you go walking upon the sea to shrink your two legs down to the knee, down to the knee? Well, I shrink your two legs down to the knee. No, I wasn't deaf, I was not blind when I left my own two legs behind. But a thundering landmine jumped in the way, wore these legs right down to the knee, down to the knee. Wore these legs right down to the knee. I was tall, I was slim, I had a leg for every limb. Then chicken hawks come knock knocking at the door. Cool Britannia called for war, she called for war. Cool Britannia called for war.
Well, that was a little snippet of My Son John by Imagined Village there. Britain is the world's second largest exporter of arms by value, and it is often assumed, therefore, the arms trade is an essential part of our economy. Is this true? Could we afford to move ethical and reduce our exports? Is the arms trade necessarily unethical? Our next guest is Nikki Jones from the Amnesty International Bristol branch. Hello.
Good. Hello. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. So tell me a little bit about the arms trade. The first thing that leaps to mind that people say is surely if we don't sell them, then somebody else will. So surely these things balance out, all being said.
Well, that may be true, but I don't think that stops our government from taking a more ethical stance. And I think that is certainly what the population of Britain have asked for, is a more ethical foreign policy and a more ethical arms trade policy. And certainly now we have the vast majority of the world's government signing up to an arms trade treaty, and that happened in December 2006, is making very slow progress at the moment. But there is an international consensus on curbing the arms trade.
Do you think that is probably maybe a little bit of a talking shop thing? Because obviously people are not going to be want to be seen saying no to it, but do you think people are realistically going to take action on this?
I think many governments are very serious about it because we're seeing throughout the world, particularly in Africa, the effects of an uncontrolled arms trade. Mm-hmm. Certainly, surely there are going to be some governments, notably some in Eastern Europe, perhaps, that are major sellers at the moment of small arms that are going to be hard to control, and whether they'll be as willing is perhaps debatable.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the extent to which Britain is trading arms? I mean, how is it directly linked to a lot of the wars that are going around the world at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think one thing, if you don't mind highlighting, first of all, is I think most people think that Britain is very heavily dependent on our arms trade, and that's one of the things that stops people thinking that this is perhaps a realistic policy. But in fact, only about 1.5% of our exports are arms. Mm-hmm. You know, when I asked a group recently, they typical answers were 40 to 60%. So people are sort of quite way out on their estimates of actually how dependent we are on that. It's only about 0.2% of our jobs in Britain. So although it seems quite a dominant industry in Bristol, it's certainly not throughout the country. I think organisations such as the Campaign Against Arms Trade and Amnesty as well would emphasise the extent to which taxpayers actually subsidise the arms industry, which is hundreds of millions of pounds per year through help with research and development, export credit guarantees and so on. So, you know, it's not the win-win for our economy that many people think it is.
Do you think perhaps that the government kind of turns a blind eye to some of the practices? Because I noticed after a very long struggle, The Guardian managed to finally get British Aerospace to out themselves as having been involved in corrupt practices, which
Absolutely.
Any other company would not get away with.
Well, and of course, quite shamefully, our government came to a plea bargain arrangement with BAE, the Serious Fraud Office did. And just to highlight one of those arms sales that was targeted by The Guardian, this was a sale of, I think, $40 million worth of military air traffic control system to Tanzania, which doesn't have a military air force. Right. It was a completely corrupt deal. Apparently, it was very personally backed by Mr. Blair, I've heard politicians say. It was very much promoted by our government. Our government gave the export guarantee to it. That's the equivalent of a huge amount of aid. That is one of the problems. The amount that we've recently sold some Hawk jets to India, for example, that's worth 10 years of our bilateral aid to India. So for that one arms sale, out 10 years
of
our aid.
If it's so obviously immoral and it doesn't contribute much to our economy, why are we doing it?
Well, I think the deal to Tanzania is very, very questionable. Why did we do it? I mean, certainly at their end, there seems to be, as ever, the arms deal is very much linked to high-level corruption. I'm sure our government would cite strategic interests. But that deal really had no sense behind it at all.
Okay.
And I think many people would say the same about our arms deals to Saudi Arabia.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what Amnesty International is doing. It normally seems to involve an awful lot of writing letters to your MP.
We do. We write letters mainly on behalf of prisoners around the world, of course. And in fact, the Bristol Group does have 3 letter writing sessions around the city per month. And if anybody wants to get involved with that, I suggest they look at the local Bristol website. So please do. There are a couple of campaigns, particularly on the arms trade.
Okay.
At the moment, the one that I'd suggest people look at the Amnesty International national website, just Google that. And at the moment, 15 of our British banks, including Barclays, HSBC and RBS, are all investing in cluster munition manufacturers. Now, that's something we have an international law on. Our own government in October 08 banned even the financing of this industry. Now, banks, even like RBS that we own, are investing in these companies.
Right.
So I really suggest people get on, just sign the petition. It's easily done.
Mm-hmm.
Make your voice heard. If I can mention one other on the Campaign Against Arms Trade website.
Easy.
At the moment, our government sponsors and helps 2 major arms fairs which are held on alternate years. One of them is owned at the moment by Clarion, the same people who do the baby show, the camping and caravan show, and so on.
Right, you know, again, eccentric mix of things. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, again, these are exporting, these are arms sales fairs. There's very little control over who comes, what deals are done, and so on.
Okay.
And I suggest again that people get onto this occasion, the Campaign Against Arms Trade website.
Okay.
Petition.
I think it'd be nice to just finish off that interview reiterating that, you know, as the Guardian have proved, if you do sort of stubbornly pursue these things, you can make headway and you can make change. So definitely check out the Amnesty International website. Stick that into your Google or favoured search engine and you'll be able to find out more about how to get involved. Thank you for coming in.
Nice to talk to you.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page and it's an interview with Sally Ray from Bristol Creatives, and that will be followed by an interview with Amy Luscombe, who has newly arrived in Bristol and is setting up Fancy Dress Life Drawing events in Stokes Croft.
My name's Sally Ray and I run Bristol Creatives, which is a networking and marketing initiative for visual artists in Bristol.
Can you tell us more about it? Like, what sort of people join your organisation?
Yeah, we're really aimed at artists, so that's visual and applied artists, which means painters, photographers, illustrators, and then also people that make things, ceramic artists, fashion designers, that kind of thing. Most of our members are sole traders, so they work on their own or they're part of small partnerships.
So what do people get out of joining?
Yeah, well, we have a fantastic website where people can upload information about what they're up to so they can tell people their news. We have an event calendar so they can publicise their exhibitions and their events, their workshops and their training courses. And then we also have a creative directory so they can publish details about a particular business. So if you're getting married and you need to buy some bespoke wedding rings and you also need to get a photographer to come and take photographs of your wedding, then you can come along to bristolcreatives.co.uk and go to the creative directory and find a jewellery maker to make your wedding rings and a photographer to take photographs of your wedding. So we appeal to artists and makers, but we also appeal to members of the public that might want to employ artists and makers to create work for them.
And it's also a good way of networking, isn't it?
That's right. Well, we send out a monthly e-bulletin, which is full of news and events and activities and opportunities for artists and makers. And then we also organise a monthly networking event on the last Thursday of the month. And this year we're on tour, so we're meeting at a different venue each month. Last month we met at the new BV Studios in Bedminster, opposite the City Farm. And today we're at Uri at Bower Ashton. And we've just had a guided tour of the fine print research facilities here. And we've been networking with about 40 or 50 students, and there was 25 artists from Bristol Creatives turned up today, and as I say, 40 students have come along too. So it's been great fun. We've been sharing their experiences about running our own businesses and giving the students tips and advice about how to launch their careers when they graduate.
So do you have a website?
We do. It's bristolcreatives.co.uk. We're just about to relaunch the website in March, so we'll have a spangly new website then. But you can find out everything about anything that's creative going on in Bristol.
Amy Luscombe.
And can you tell us what you're doing in Bristol?
I'm here trying to become an established artist and meet people, network and enjoy Bristol life, really.
You've just graduated, have you?
I graduated from Plymouth College of Art in Applied Arts, which was basically covering glassblowing, metal sculptures, ceramics, and small-scale jewellery work, so, and beadwork as well, and I branched off and did screen printing, so...
Fancy drawing classes, that sounds fun.
It was something that we wanted to, basically I wanted to bring the community together and get people involved, and it came about that there was this, the new cafe that had opened, the Art House Cafe in Stokescroft. The address is 108A in Stokescroft, and there was such a lovely atmosphere there that I felt that I wanted to approach them to take this idea forward. And it was something, since coming up to Bristol, I found that I'm going to quite a lot of parties involving fancy dress, and it's always really fun, and everyone's always laughing and smiling. It just seemed to make sense that drawing something that's not just a naked body, it's more interesting. You've got more lines, more details that you can sculpt into it. You know, you don't have to use pens and paper. I started doing quick stencils and things like that, so I just felt that there was more to offer with this.
So it says on your leaflet that this is free.
Yeah, it is free. I would like to ask for donations, and I would quite like to give it to a charity of some sort. It starts from 7 till 9, which is live drawing, and then afterwards we've got some poetry and then live music. Donations would be appreciated.
Are you planning to do any more of these events?
Definitely. I almost do one once a fortnight or maybe once a month. I really feel that this is going to take off, and I would quite like, if it does, then I'd quite like to take it further to maybe doing things at festivals and getting involved. I know they have festivals at St. Werburgh's, and then, you know, maybe taking it even further and getting people to do screen printing with it, and, you know, being able to sell their prints. There's so many opportunities that I could go with this. Yeah, it's really good.
So, have you got a website?
At the moment, I'm doing Facebook.
Have you got a telephone number?
I've got a telephone number. My number is 07814 900 209, or you can contact me on my email, which is aims_surf@hotmail.com. You can get hold of me on Facebook. It's under IMA, which is IMAEJ Luscombe Facebook.
That was Anthony Page there, our very own, talking to Sally Ray from Bristol Creatives and Amy Luscombe. Short piece of music now. This is a track from Lucy Phillips.
Cuando sono solo sogno l'orizzonte. Con te.
That was Lucy Phillips there, a first-year music student at the University of Chichester, singing Time to Say Goodbye. Welcome now to Dan Isles. Dan is here to talk about ideas and ethos behind setting up the Bristol Convention of the Left, which will invite a coalition of all the left-wing agencies in Bristol to take part on the 13th of March in Easton. Hello.
Hi, Daniel. Nice to meet you.
So tell me a little bit about your political background and where you're from. Are you a member of a political party?
No, I'm a Marxist, but I've never really affiliated with anyone. I've kind of grown up as a sort of anti-Iraq war sort of generation, where I came to university trying to be sort of quite political, and soon found struggling against a sort of apolitical mass. But then I've recently been trying to sort of regenerate a sort of left-wing movement on in the university.
Okay, right. I mean, Marxism is, some people might suggest that sort of Marxism has kind of died a death, really. It's a little bit
it has got a very good critique of capitalism, and there's a lot of problems going on in the world. But I guess I'm trying to make it more applicable to local politics, to other things. And one thing I've found very interesting in my course is about social movements, mm-hmm. And how powerful they can be. If you look in places like Latin America, when you bring them together, and the uniting of different certain things, they can really change things.
Okay, so you're particularly interested in it as a bottom-up method of political movement rather
than
top-down.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So what sort of reaction to this have you had in Bristol? What sort of different groups of people have you met?
In order to try and promote this convention of the left, I've been going around different parts of Bristol, and what's been really interesting is that I've been going to all the different campaigns going on. There's the feminist movement, there's the green movement, there's Against the Able Mouth biofuel generator.
Yeah.
There was the pro-Palestinian solidarity group, especially at BG Link, a Palestinian solidarity campaign.
Yeah.
Loads of different anti-fascist movements, like with the anti-platform of BNP stuff recently.
Yeah.
What's really good is that there's this kind of enthusiasm across the board to try and bring it into a sort of conference where people can talk about these things.
Okay.
And workshops and kind of where participation is encouraged.
So in a decentralised sort of mass of people, doesn't sound like they're ever going to make a decision about anything as a united force.
Well, the idea that the day is split up into different workshops, so there'll be four workshops in every hour, and in these workshops there'll be a facilitator, so they'll be able to talk about the strategies, and people who have been in the movement for a while, also people who are new to the movement, and with them people can share experience that they've had of different things, be it on the green movement, the anarchist movement, the left wing socialist movement, trade unions, and they can be able to strategize.
Definitely a chance for networking and discovering new views.
So
I mean, whereabouts in Easton is this taking place?
Easton Community Centre.
Okay.
It's in on Kilburn Street. Why Easton is really good for it is because it's a very community centred place. And that's the kind of aspect of what social movements is about. It's about recreating a left-wing community in Bristol. There is already a massive one, but bring it together, which I think is important.
Okay. You've got a leaflet here, which I'm looking at, and there's a whole range of topics that you're going to discuss. Defending public services, solidarity with Latin America, war and peace, the environment and climate change, fascism, racism, Islamophobia, defending civil liberties, gender equality, unemployment and the economic crisis, and electoral strategy building a movement. Now, that last one, are you particularly interested in building an electoral strategy with anybody of any particular...
I'm not supporting any political parties per se, but I'm going to leave my mind open until after
this
convention.
This is a chance for people to make
their
minds up.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's also a chance to put the power into the people instead of the politicians, if you know what I mean.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I think you've got a taste of it. So that's on the 13th of March. Turn up for about 10 a.m. Towards sort of midday.
Yeah, Eastern Community Centre.
Eastern Community Centre in Kilburn Street.
Cool.
Danal, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
It's time for the honeyed tones of Malcolm Greaves, the wonderful actor reading this week's instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
By A.G. Street. After Haymaking Thoughts, 1931. This title looks a bit queer somehow, but I cannot think of a better one. I've puzzled as to whether it should be Haymaking Afterthoughts, Afterthoughts on Haymaking, or Thoughts After Haymaking, and I have decided that the chosen alternative will pass muster. After all, many of us are compelled at times to listen to after-dinner speeches. One presumes that the bathers at Lansbury's Lido experience that incomparable afterglow. And some fortunate beings, I believe, consume after-theatre suppers. And these last must surely experience some afterthoughts in the still watches of the night. So you see that when you start playing about with the word after, there is no limit to its possibilities, and as all haymakers know the meaning of the word aftermath, why shouldn't I have some after-haymaking thoughts? Very well, then. In actual fact, it is a very bold thing even to suggest afterthoughts in connection with this season's haymaking. For at one time it looked as though there could be no possible hope of getting it finished before Christmas. Most farmers are feeling that they always have been haymaking, that they always will be haymaking, and that, for their sins, they will be condemned in the future to toil unceasingly and ineffectively in some enormous hayfield in the nether regions. Still, report hath it that hell has a dry climate, and the thought of His Satanic Majesty operating an infernal crop dryer in the hayfields of Hades is surely comforting to anybody who has been trying this season to make hay in this country. A farmer's life during the past 2 months of June and July can best be described by conjugating the verb to haymake in the manner of one's grammar books of years ago. Let us see how it works out. The sentences in brackets are the farmer's thoughts, which are not included in agricultural textbooks as a general rule, and in this case, for decency's sake, only an expurgated edition will be given. I haymake, he haymakes, they haymake. But nobody is working half as hard as I am. What the modern farm labourer is coming to, I cannot imagine. These fellows who have drawn the dole aren't worth finding. Lord, I can jump over half these young chaps. They don't earn salt for their porridge. Why the... What the... I am about to haymake. We've just got the whole team into the field ready to start. And now it started to drizzle. Look at that cloud. Another day wasted. I shall haymake. Shall I? Not today, nor tomorrow, nor as far as I can see ever again. The glass is falling steadily. Thank heaven it can't go sideways. that I may haymake. I have turned the stuff umpteen times at no small expense. Now here comes the rain. Well, you had better all go hedge trimming. Go somewhere, anywhere, do something, anything, nothing if you like, as long as you get out of my sight. I don't want a continuous reminder of what you are costing me to no useful purpose. I will go indoors and read about something dry, as everything in this country is wet through. Droughts in America, prospectors dying of thirst under a merciless sun, or stories entitled The Empty Barrel, or something equally cheering. I will haymake. This tense is used when the farmer's patience is exhausted, when he is no longer a reasonable human being, but a berserk who will haymake whatever happens. Oh yes, I am fully aware that the hay is not fit, that if it is stacked the rick will get hot, that it is better to spoil it in the field than in the stack, that it would be wiser to wait until tomorrow. That you are right and I am wrong, but I will haymake. And so on, ad libitum, until at last one can say with a sigh of relief, I have haymaked. Still, it must have been patent to everyone this summer that the British farmer has come off second best in his annual haymaking struggle with the clerk of the weather. Although on the average, he does not do too badly. Looking back on my own farming, I find I have experienced some bad seasons, some good ones, and some middling ones. But that on the whole, I have little cause to grumble at the weather. Even during this season's wet hay harvest, I find that I have made 120 acres of good hay, 30 acres of indifferent quality, as well as some 40 acres of almost valueless stuff. One of my neighbours tells me that he has made all good hay, while another says that he has harvested all bad. In a catchy season, there is always a certain amount of luck in these things. But better than luck is luck aided and abetted by the courage to take chances and to cut losses. Anyone can farm when the weather farms for him, but it takes a real farmer to play farmer's glory with the British climate and draw money at the end of the season's play. Still, it's great fun trying to do it. And I do not quite agree with the farmer who, when he was asked whether there was any calamity which could happen to a British farmer that had not happened already, said, "Yes, the fool might continue to farm." That's too gloomy an afterthought for me, even after this disastrous season.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Thank you very much to the actor Malcolm Greaves there for that excellent reading of Hedge Trimmings. And now, onwards to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, our resident bard. Hello.
Hello, John.
How's your week?
It's been interesting, yeah. What I've got this week is a ditty about RBS. Of course, the bankers have, and the bonuses have been in the news. So,
mm-hmm.
So this is about that. Now, the bonus season's here again for those who are in control. This system surely looks insane for those who are on the dole. The government say it's not right, yet we are left to pay. Our cash is tied so we can't fight and bankers get their way. Behold this awful sleazy mess, they're stealing hard-earned money. They pile distress upon distress. It really isn't funny. Oh, what a mess at RBS! The bankers call the tune, our leaders cave in to duress, while we howl at the moon. I can't assess the deep distress this mess has left us in. It's sad, it's wrong, and yet I guess there's no way we can win. a sad lament.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, I feel a bit depressed now. No, I'm just joking. Thank you very much. Well, here he is once again pretending to be somebody who's escaped from Alcatraz Psycho Ward with the aid of a handy prop shirt. The man in black, Jeff Sparks, and he's going to tell us what's on in Bristol. Hello.
Hello, John. Thank you. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 10th of March, Stiff Little Fingers will be performing with support from Penetration at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. Tickets are £14 in advance. On Thursday, 11th of March, Fun Loving Criminals will be performing with support from The Chemists at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 12th of March, the Clash tribute group London Calling will be performing with support from the fanzines at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. On to the Song of the Week, and I feature Tragedy, all metal tribute to the Bee Gees. This is from the download-only charity compilation album, The Haiti Project, which you can get from www.musicglue.com for £5, and is the track Nights on Broadway.
Blaming it out. I'm on the town right way. Singing them love songs. Singing them straight to the house. I'm blaming it out.
That was Tragedy, all metal tribute to the Bee Gees, with Nights on Broadway from the album The Haiti Project, which you can get from www.musicglue.com. The album features 16 tracks, all for £5, and all the money will be donated to the ongoing relief efforts. Moving on to Saturday 13th of March, and Dr. Feelgood will be performing at the Thunderbolts on Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 13th of March, Kick the Cat will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday 14th of March, Soul Dressing will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
And away he goes, back to the Psycho Award. Thank you, Mr. Jeff Sparks. Time for a little appeal just at the end before we go. This was emailed to Anthea earlier on, and she wants me to read it out. So this is regarding Mohammad Yusuf Rashidi, who's an Iranian student and a protester. And this is how the impact of the media can wind people getting up in hot water. He is in danger of being hanged in Iran because he daringly held a banner that was addressed to the president, Ahmadinejad, of course, during his visit to a polytechnic in Tehran. Mohammad Yusuf Rashidi held the banner reading, "There is no place in the polytechnic for a fascist president." The photo was taken of him and it was published on the internet, and millions saw him with the banner on news websites all over the world. He was arrested soon after and has been in detention ever since, and he's now in danger of being executed. So if you want to save this student from execution, please contact your local MP, Amnesty International, of course you can just look that up on the web, or any other human rights organisation that you know of who you know would take an interest. Just to reiterate, that guy's name is Mohammad Yusuf Rashidi, and you spell Yusuf Y-O-U-S-E-F, Rashidi. Well, that's all. We've run out of time. So thank you very much for listening to this week's Dialect Radio Show. You can look us up on iTunes now. If you go on the iTunes website and you can look up Dialect Radio, and you can follow us there. We've also got a Twitter account. You can follow us in the virtual sense, of course. I'm sure you love us, but not quite that much. Twitter.com/dialectradio, where I'm sure we'll have lots of fascinating things to tell you. And, of course, you can message us back and get a bit interactive. Yeah. Thank you very much to the studio guests this week. We had Chris Lees from the UKIP party, Nikki Jones from Amnesty International, David Isles to discuss the Convention of the Left Day at the Eastern Community Centre on Saturday the 13th of March, and Paul Hazenden of the Wild Goose Cafe on City Road in St Paul's, where they offer help to homeless people. Malcolm Greaves read Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, and the features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. Eagerly listeners will have noticed, of course, we've had a lot of interaction with politicians over the past few weeks, not least UKIP, of course, and we've also had the Liberal Democrats and Labour on the phone from Westminster. We're hoping in the coming weeks to get a Conservative candidate or spokesman on the show, but so far they've not got back to us and they don't appear to be interested in coming on. They're the only people who aren't interested so far. Thank you very much to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Dialect Radio, and to Jeff Sparks for the What's On Guide. The studio engineers were Johnny Royden and Andy Gordon, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Common. Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.